This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Little known fact about today's unemployment report, y'all. The margin of error on that sucker is 90,000. 90,000. So consider that alongside the disappointing headline number, will you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 5th of September. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Let's get right to it, shall we? So much to talk about, so little time. Today's jobs report, for example, 142,000 new jobs. The European Central Bank this week and its interest rates, what all of that means for you and for me. Four, maybe 4.5 minutes of live radio, we like to call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Lee, you heard the number this morning, 142,000, and you said what?
Well, I mean, at first blush, it does feel like, oh, gosh, this is so terrible. We just came off these six straight months of great jobs numbers. And it just feels like, again, we're lurching kind of two steps forward, one step back. But if you drill down a little bit, first of all, you made a great point. The margin of error is huge. And, you know, August job numbers are traditionally more revised than others because people are away and such. But if you look in certain numbers, like the people who are working part-time and want to be full-time, that actually fell. And then the number of people who work or out of work 6 months or more, that actually fell too. So we have this kind of reentrant story that's still happening, and that's really important. So jobs are still a huge problem in our economy, but this isn't as bad as it seems.
Sudeep, a blip or should I be worried?
It's probably a blip. The reason there's a crazy person screaming from Kai Rizdal's Twitter account on every jobs report day is because we're talking about 90,000. There's a pool of 140 million payroll jobs we're talking about. That is a huge number of payroll jobs. So a move of 142,000 is a blip in itself. And that's the big risk of focusing on a monthly number in this jobs report. If you look at the overall longer running trend, we're seeing annual job growth of about 2%. You're seeing wage growth of about 2%. You're seeing economic growth of about 2%. You're seeing an economy that is moving sideways, and it has been moving sideways for several years. We haven't gotten the escape velocity we've all been hoping for, and we're clearly not seeing it now.
For those who don't follow me on Twitter, it's at Kai Rizdal, by the way. I do this thing every month where I tweet out the margin of error because, honestly, I think it kind of matters when you got 142,000 new jobs. Anyway, Lee, the next bullet item here on my list of things to talk to you guys about is WWJYD. What would Janet Yellen do now with this number, right? Because it's all about what the Fed's going to do with interest rates and all that stuff. Do you think this changes their plans at all?
No, I don't think it does. And I think, in fact, that's a reassuring element about all this. I think that the Fed is still on track to raise rates middle of next year. Mm-hmm. I think everything remains copacetic. And I think that alone is enough to relax markets.
Well, as you saw today, right? And copacetic, by the word, great.
Exactly.
By the way, great word.
Thank you.
Sudeep, take me to Europe, would you? Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank, came out this week. And you have to say it was a shocker, right? They lowered already low interest rates to essentially zero, and then did their own smaller version of quantitative easing, bond buying. How big a deal really is that globally and then for us?
It's a big deal for European markets because there wasn't a whole lot of expectation that Mario Draghi would be able to act. In his own terms, he's done all that they can within mm-hmm. these tools. And by lowering rates even further, it's probably not going to change the dynamics of the Eurozone. The ECB president was very forthright, saying you need economic overhauls in the Eurozone countries. These 18 countries have to make broader, deeper changes to matter. This is the same issue everyone's facing. Central bankers cannot solve Europe's problems. Central bankers cannot solve the problems of Japan or of the United States. It takes elected officials to go and do some of the harder work that's entailed, that's required yeah. to make economies more competitive and to make workers better. All those things have to happen. And what the ECB is doing is probably necessary, but it's really not sufficient to get these economies revived and off the ground.
Right. Speaking of elected officials, by the way, Congress comes back next week, right, Sadiq?
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine in New York, Sadiq Reddy from The Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, slow start, strong-ish finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The NATO summit in Wales wrapped up today with the obligatory post-summit communique. The headline item is a new rapid reaction force to defend Eastern Europe against more Russian incursions, I guess you could say. Also, regular military exercises along Europe's eastern borders. Here, then, is the obligatory question. Is the alliance ready to put its money where its mouth is? From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Europe's share of NATO's defence spending has shrunk to less than a third since the financial crisis. Under pressure to cut their deficits, European governments have slashed defence budgets to the bone. Will that change now the Russian bear is rampaging around eastern Ukraine? Malcolm Chalmers of the Royal United Services Institute.
It probably means an end to further reductions in defence spending in NATO Europe as a whole, but I think the jury is still out as to whether it will mean significant increases.
NATO has 28 members. Only four of them meet the alliance's defence spending target, at least 2% of GDP. At this week's summit, the Brits called on their European allies to spend more. They got only a vague commitment to do so, says Dan Plesch at the Centre for International Studies and Diplomacy.
I don't think there's any appetite for that in Europe. There is such concern to get the economies moving again.
And he says, given America's massive military might, the truth is that NATO doesn't need to spend much more to meet any threat from Russia.
The reality that the Russians are hugely militarily inferior to the West mean that there's little real objective need for new military capability, rather a little spending on redeployment.
But America's patience with Europe's paltry spending on defence is wearing thin, and Russia is upgrading. Within 2 years, the Russians will spend more on their military than Germany and France combined. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Speaking of spending money, Tesla, as has been widely reported the past couple of days, has just made a big bet in the battery space. A $5 billion factory in Nevada that'll produce batteries at unheard-of scale and thus, in accordance with the laws of supply and demand, push down the price of said batteries. Now, Tesla founder Elon Musk does tend to speak with an air of certainty around him. The promised land of electric cars is not far off, is kind of how his spiel goes. But that doesn't mean there aren't still a whole lot of questions about it. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Better, cheaper, smaller. That's the promise of tomorrow's batteries and their many evangelists, says clean energy investor Matthew Norden.
But if you look at the number of announcements, promises, high hopes, explorations to the number of things that actually deliver and ship, it's a pretty narrow funnel.
But say step change does happen. Cost savings could chop the price of a $14,000 electric car battery in half. Entrepreneurs like UC Berkeley chemist Stephen Visco could make batteries with triple the driving range.
It'd be awfully nice to have a fully charged vehicle that would take you, say, 300 to 400 miles on a single charge.
All that assumes our relationship with cars will stay the same, that we each own one and have to refuel it. business professor David Kirsch at the University of Maryland is not so sure.
Maybe we all just call an Uber or a Google car, and we don't care how it's powered or how much it costs. We're kind of predicting marginal changes. We may be missing the radical change.
The kind of change steam engines brought, and semiconductors and petroleum. As far as batteries, well, big leaps in energy storage could turn our homes into baby power plants or electrify a drone economy. Ridiculous? Berkeley's Stephen Visco recalls a conference in the early 90s where this crazy question turned up.
Is it possible that we'll see lithium-ion batteries in power tools? And it was immediately reviled as a crazy idea. There's no way. It's dangerous.
And today, we're drilling away. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The once and future shortage of coders and programmers in the tech industry has been well documented out there. There may be as many as a million job openings in that business over the next decade or so. And that, in turn, has kicked a bunch of schools into gear. Some of them have even started teaching every kid some basic coding skills. One problem, though, there is also a shortage of coding teachers. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
Apple founder Steve Jobs has a famous quote from the 90s. He said, "Everyone should learn how to program a computer." And now, everyone's echoing him, from President Obama to rappers like Will.i.am.
It should be mandatory to be a citizen on this planet, whatever country you're from, to read and write code.
There are several programs for kids to teach themselves how to code, like code.org. But for schools that take the leap, good luck finding a coding teacher.
We need to train students today who have the skills that we don't have, but we don't have enough people who have the skills to teach it.
Ravi Gupta runs a group of charter schools in Nashville that decided to make coding mandatory this year. But when he started looking for teachers, he basically found none.
We all knew that our students needed the skills, but none of us knew how to tackle the challenge. So we just are starting to teach ourselves as we teach students, not because that's the ideal situation, but because it is the only way.
This first lesson, I think, is something that should be pretty straightforward, and if we get done early, then that's wonderful.
In an echoey classroom, Ryan York leads a one-month crash course for a group of teachers who know almost nothing about coding, even though that's what they're teaching this year. Day one is animating a cartoon fish.
But it's just getting a fish to be able to swim back and forth on its own accord without flipping upside down when it bounces off the edge of the canvas.
The teachers, hunched over laptops, are learning a fairly rudimentary coding language called Scratch, developed by MIT. They'll work up to projects like building an on-screen piano. It's harder than it sounds.
I'm getting there.
Ben Kyle is one of those hired to teach coding. He admits it may be a long first year.
And I actually roomed with two computer science guys in college, so I got to watch them go through the whole process. And, you know, in hindsight now, I wish I had done a little bit more learning from them along the way.
So your closest connection to being a coder is that you roomed with a couple in college.
Yes.
School leaders are spinning the lack of experience as a potential plus. Teachers can identify with their students because they're just a few steps ahead. Around the world, schools are dealing with this circular problem where kids need to learn coding, but teachers can't teach it. England's primary schools have mandated programming classes, but a recent survey finds teachers don't think they're ready, even calling the preparation chaotic. And when a teacher does master an in-demand skill like coding, will they actually stay in the classroom? Or will they be poached by the higher-paying tech industry?
We have definitely had that happen.
Mike Palmer runs a teacher training program based in St. Louis called Code Red. One newly minted coding teacher recently left for greener pastures.
We basically trained her up to be a coder. She ended up self-training herself a little bit more, and she ended up getting a job in the private sector. I don't know if that's us doing our job too well or not, but it's happened.
Palmer says it's further proof that coding is a skill worth teaching to every student. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the Grunge Collection, which today is rightly regarded as the most seminal American collection of the 1990s, was at the time a colossal failure.
Sometimes you got it, sometimes I guess you don't. But first, let's do the numbers. Jobs report? What jobs report? Dow Industrials added 0.4%. Today, 67 points. Closed at 17,137. The NASDAQ also picked up 0.4%. 20 points. Ended things at 4582. The S&P 500 climbed 0.5%. 10 points. Finished at another record high, 2007. For the week that was, the Dow and the S&P each took home 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained less than 0.1%. Here's the logic on that markets and the jobs report. The lackluster jobs report, actually good news to companies hoping the Fed will delay raising interest rates even longer than planned, no matter what Lee Gallagher said. Financial firms not among them, however. Shares at Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley all down less than 0.3%, pretty much across the board. J.P. Morgan Chase up 0.3%. It's Fashion Week in New York, as you will hear later on in the broadcast, and the hot color is red, as in ink. Gap threw off 4% after announcing weak same-store sales in August. Michael Kors gave back 4.5% after a big investor bailed on the shares. It's been having a rough go, Michael Kors has. I know that. How about that? Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stuck at 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue July consumer credit data. What's in your pantry? Tomato, chicken and rice, or cream of mushroom? Campbell Soup releases quarterly earnings. And singer Pink has a birthday. She'll be 35. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in Wow, Really? News, there is this. Dancing with the Stars on ABC has announced the lineup for its 19th, yes, its 19th season. Featured is one Bethany Mota. If the name doesn't ring a bell, just go ask your teenage daughter. Mota has more than 7 million followers on her YouTube channel, which is dedicated mostly to hairstyles and teen fashion. Marketplace's Queena Kim explains why the networks want to start dancing with the internet.
Y'all know about Dancing with the Stars, but what about Bethany Mota?
Hey guys, so for today's video, I am going to be doing a morning routine. Unfortunately, even though it is summer, I have had a lot of very busy summer days. But
if you're saying to yourself like I was, seriously, 6 minutes of this? Then you're not part of the demographic that Dancing with the Stars is hoping to attract with its new hire. Karen North is a professor of digital and social media at USC.
Right now, everybody's looking to integrate stars from YouTube into traditional television. And the primary reason is to bring in the younger audience.
That younger audience isn't watching shows on TV as much as they are online. While the majority of YouTube's viewers are 35 and under, the median age of Dancing with the Stars is 60.
I'm not sure if her audience will translate over.
Janine Poggi covers TV for Advertising Age.
But Bethany Mota has such a big following. Her social presence and her being able to promote the show, that in and of itself is just a huge draw for ABC.
Brian Steinberg is a TV reporter at Variety, and he says the Mota news is a sign of things to come.
It's an interesting gambit to see if someone who is a viral star has what it takes to become a broadcast star.
He says YouTube stars often have a niche following, but primetime requires a different kind of star power. One that'll attract a diverse and broad-based audience. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
You ought to check them out. Those videos are kind of a trip, I got to tell you. All right, moving on. The business model for higher education, as we know it, is in trouble. Costs are rising way faster than inflation. Online learning is a threat, and colleges are competing for an applicant pool that is not what it used to be. So some of those schools are getting creative. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
The postcard-perfect campus of Goucher College might seem out of reach to students from low-income families or those with iffy grades on their transcripts. New president Jose Antonio Bowen wants to change that.
There are tens of thousands of high school seniors each year that do not apply to any selective liberal arts college like Goucher College, despite the fact that they would get in.
To attract more of those students, this week Goucher introduced a new way to apply to the college by making a video.
That's it. No test scores, no transcripts.
All students need to do is fill out a brief application, send two samples of their work in high school, and submit a 2-minute video introducing themselves. Bowen says production value doesn't matter.
You can use your phone, you can tell us who you are, and be admitted to college. That's a simple, straightforward message that I hope will resonate with lots of 18-year-olds.
Colleges are fighting hard for those 18-year-olds. After a big boom, the number of high school seniors is shrinking in the Midwest and Northeast. David Strauss is a higher ed consultant with Art and Science Group.
The demographics are getting more challenging. The economic pressures remain on families, and all of this adds up to a need for institutions to compete ever more effectively against each other for the students they need.
Last year, Bard College introduced an essay-only application. It's meant to attract talented students whose grades or test scores might not reflect their potential. Just 40 out of 6,000 applicants went that route, but nearly half of them got in. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Everybody who's anybody in the rarefied world of high fashion is in New York City. Fashion Week is once again upon us. And that's fine. Runways, parties, air kisses, and all that. But every now and then, a little history can be helpful. Provide a little context for what's right in front of you. Maureen Callahan provides some of that in her new book. It's called Champagne Supernovas, Kate Moss, Marc Jacobs, Alexander McQueen, and the 90s Renegades Who Remade Fashion. Maureen, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much, Kai.
Why did you pick these three people to anchor this book?
These three individuals, Kate Moss, Marc Jacobs, and Alexander McQueen, epitomized the revolution that took place in the 90s in fashion. And they remain as culturally relevant today as they were 20 years ago.
The odd one out of these three, it seemed to me, was Marc Jacobs, right? I mean, by the time this book starts, he's already won a big fashion award. He's the VP at Perry Ellis, right? The big mm-hmm. the big fashion house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me he needs much of a boost, and yet he engineers a lot of the grunge and a lot of the move toward sort of that kind of fashion.
You know, it's interesting because I agree with you on the surface of it. It does seem as though Marc Jacobs is the odd one out. Mm-hmm. It's easy to see why. I mean, he is the most famous, impactful, influential American designer, I think, ever. But he, like Kate and McQueen, has a dark origin story. The grunge collection, which today is rightly regarded as the most seminal American collection of the 1990s, was at the time a colossal failure. The critics loathed it. The buyers did not know what to do with it. The editors hated it. And the girls he was designing for thought it was a highly cynical co-option of their authentic organic culture. They thought Marc Jacobs killed it.
You know, it's interesting because you say at some point in this book, early on, actually, you talk about what rock and roll was to the 50s, drugs to the 60s, film to the 70s, and modern art to the 80s, fashion was to the 90s. So what is fashion today going to be to the early 2010s?
Well, I think what you see now, and again, this is really a legacy of the 90s, is a democratization of fashion that's unprecedented. A lot of that does have to do with technology. You know, the idea that you can go to H&M and buy something days after it was shown on a high fashion runway for a fraction of the price,
yeah,
and then throw it away when it's no longer on trend. But you also have the rise of street style blogs, and you have the idea that any girl on the street can be shot by a photographer, put up online, and that can be an aspirational image for anyone. So fashion now is far more open than it ever has been. Bloggers are seated front row at shows alongside Anna Wintour.
For all that accessibility, though, the high-end stuff, and this is true of all things in all times, the high-end stuff is still really high-end and out of reach for, you know, 90-plus percent of the population.
It absolutely is. But say you see a piece in Vogue that you really would love, but it's that or your rent, you know. You wait you wait 2-3 weeks, some high street chain, whether it be Zara or Topshop or H&M, they're knocking it off, and you can have it. You can buy it. You can buy it for a fraction of the price.
2-3 weeks? That speed? That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it becomes this really poisonous feedback loop because now high-end designers, the pressure on them to keep producing is incredible for exactly this reason. You really just have to create newer and more product to convince women that they absolutely need to buy this to be on trend. Mm. And, you know, every designer worth their salt, from Marc Jacobs to Tom Ford to Nicolas Ghesquiere, who's just taken over for Marc Jacobs, has said that the production schedule is crazy and completely inhuman and unnecessary.
It's a book called Champagne Supernovas by Maureen Callahan. Maureen, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which is honestly kind of sad. It turns out that nobody in this country trusts anybody anymore. There's a study out in the journal Psychological Science that shows, among a whole bunch of other things, that back in the early 1970s, 46% of American adults agreed most people can be trusted. Now, just 33% of adults agree with that statement. And I'll tell you what, it gets worse. They asked 12th graders the same question in the late 1970s. 32% agreed that most people can be trusted. Now, just 18% of high school seniors agree that most people can be trusted. The phrase you're looking for here is declining social capital. And that is not a good thing. All right, we are done. That is the broadcast for this afternoon. Today, the Dow up 0.4%, 67 points. The NASDAQ also up 0.4%, 20 points. The S&P 500 up 0.5%, that is 10 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We're back on Monday, and this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.